why don't we go ahead and start with the Senator Hensley's bill first? Call the House Labor Commerce Committee to order. It's order to March 10th. And present our members, Copeland, Boucher, Bernard, Furness, Ellis, and Donnelly. And the first matter on the agenda today is Senate Resolution SCR 44. Is there a member of Senator Hensley's staff here? Would you like to address the committee on this?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob Arnold. I work for Senator Hensley, who has intended to be here to speak on behalf of this resolution, but who is tied up in a teleconference at this time. First, I would like to convey Senator Hensley's appreciation, Mr. Chairman, for your scheduling this bill for this resolution. This resolution aims at obtaining more accurate information about unemployment levels or jobless levels in Alaska. In part, the problem is that the Department of Labor, the Alaska Department of Labor, is reporting unemployment levels in Senator Hensley's district of 9 or 10%. Surveys carried out there show unemployment levels of 40 or 50%. In part, the problem that leads to this resolution is that in urban areas suffering economic distress, unemployment levels officially reported may understate the situation, for if there are no jobs to be found, persons become discouraged and are not counted as the unemployed. Though I've referred to the Alaska Department of Labor, the problem is not the Alaska Department of Labor. The problem is the U.S. Department of Labor and the rules that have to be followed. It is the methodology and the definitions that are required to be employed in the gathering of data on unemployment. According to these definitions of unemployment, they're very complicated, but you need to have sought work in the last 4 weeks in order to be counted as among the unemployed. And if you're in an area, for instance, in rural Alaska, in a small village, where you know no jobs are available, there is not much good sense shown to go out looking for work when you know there are jobs available. Based upon a survey carried out by our own Alaska Department of Labor in 1981, the House Research Agency concluded that the official methodology, I mean the federal methodology, tends to overestimate employment and underestimate unemployment in rural areas. Senator Hensley believes that in these especially difficult times we are in now, that it's even more important that we obtain as accurate a picture of levels of joblessness in Alaska as we can. Finally, about $4 billion in federal grants are distributed throughout the nation on the basis of unemployment data. So the resolution asks two things. First of all, it asks that the Department of Labor prepare its best estimate, drawing upon any kind of source of information about levels of real joblessness in Alaska today. Without disrespect for the federal methodology, that data still must be gathered. The second thing it asks is that the department advise the legislature what steps can be taken to change the federal methodology, or I should say, to influence changes in the federal methodology, so that in the future, the official estimates will come more nearly close to representing the real levels of unemployment in Alaska. Have you questions?
Representative Furness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Mr. Arnold, I know the requirement of the need to report in and the probability that in a rural community, because the persons know that there are no jobs, the tendency not to report in, which again makes sense. The resolution basically does not strike at that, and it is my understanding that reporting requirement is what is normally used to determine the unemployment stats. How does the senator propose to use this resolution in order to change the reporting requirements, again, which is used, in my understanding, to develop the basis for the stats?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, one of the elements is reporting to the unemployment office, but it's not the only one used by the Department of Labor. And that the department's representatives are here. It's a very the summary, the simplified explanation is a very long one. This resolution, apart from that, this resolution doesn't really get at that issue, because those requirements are federally fixed. It gets at it only over time, in that through this resolution, the legislature asks the Department of Labor, tell us what steps we can take to try to influence the federal authorities in order that these rules of collection, these rules of data collection, can be changed, probably looking at a year to 5 years to bring about that change.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions for the witness? Representative Boucher.
I'd like to commend the Senator on introducing this legislation. I'm familiar, quite familiar with federally funded programs that deal with unemployment in the state. And, of course, the feds, like everything else, give us the dollars to from which we grind out these unemployment numbers. And so I think that they're doing it the same as they would in Illinois and what have you, and the feds are going to have to take a slightly different look, or we have constantly got an imbalanced picture being presented to the people of the state. And another thing, too, because of the, I guess the favorite expression of yours, gridlock that we are in by getting the federal dollars, our entire approach to economic indicators is off base here. In other words, the very things that we're attempting now to raise the status or the health of our economy, such things as consumer spending and other really vital things are left out of there. Now, I know the federal government, by and large, pretty well says, well, if you want the money, you'll do it our way. But I would recommend that that we make sure that, and the couple we have here already, I'd like to see something in here that calls it to the attention of our delegation in Washington once again. Now, I don't want to mess around with the legislation. I would like to see the thing move on. I guess it's got another committee referral. Is that the finance? Or?
I don't think
so.
No,
we're the only committee of referral. Well, I don't want to slow it up, Mr. Chairman, because I think it's very important that this piece of legislation move on. But it calls attention not just to one problem in rural Alaska, but to a larger problem. We base our decisions on unemployment figures in this state. Almost all of our decisions here, that's what Mr. Erickson will be telling us, unemployment has leveled out. So I would somehow or other like to call this to the attention of our representatives in Washington and indicate that it's a very high priority, because it certainly touches on a troublesome spot. And I'll leave it to the chair to decide how we do that. I just wanted to express that concern.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, pleased in Senator Inslee's office to send it to the delegation once the action by both houses is complete. Secondly, if I may, the Department of Labor, the Alaska Department of Labor, a few years ago, after diligent effort, was able to bring about a change, which I cannot describe as well as it's represented, a change in the federal collection of methodology. So it's possible, but it takes a lot of work.
The federal unemployment statistics criteria were changed several times. It's very difficult to follow consistently through the years for that reason. And wasn't there another change that limited the number of weeks that one was counted unemployed, also most recently? Like 8 weeks. After 8 weeks of unemployment, you are no longer unemployed. You are maybe on permanent leave. I don't know. Somebody from the Department of Labor here can report on that. Chuck, you want to join us?
What are the current? If you could tell us what the changes in the unemployment, the definition through the years have been, and what's the most recent definition of unemployment for the purposes of counting the statistics.
So, Chuck, if you could give us the abbreviated version of that, we'd really appreciate it.
First, on the definitions.
You need to identify yourself.
All right. My name is Chuck Caldwell. I'm Chief of Research of Alaska Department of Labor. There have been changes in benefit programs over time, but that hasn't changed the definition of the statistical programs. Last time the statistical programs changed was in the 1960s as far as definitions. So that's been fairly stable on those definitions. There, I guess that's in response to your question. I don't know if there was others you wanted me to address.
Okay. Any other questions for either of the witnesses? Okay. Are there any members of the public here to testify in this legislation? What's the will of the committee?
I'll move it out.
The individual recommendation?
Yes, and however we carry the comments, I guess that covers it.
Okay, any objections to the motion? Thank you. Okay, next matter on the agenda is... Senate Joint Resolution 33. Hi. I see we have a representative of Senator Tertullo's office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Beth Tertullo. I'm a volunteer on Senator Tertullo's staff. Senator Tertullo apologizes for not being here today. He is in Senate Judiciary Committee chairing that meeting. Thank you for the hearing. Senate Joint Resolution 33 is a consumer right to know bill. This is not a ban on irradiated foods. I know there are other legislation pending right now that would accomplish that if passed. But this is simply a resolution to let the Federal Drug Administration know that Alaskans disapprove of doing away with labeling requirements and that we would like to have all foods that are irradiated or that contain irradiated ingredients labeled as such. I'm not a scientist, but I definitely eat food. And I want to know what's in my food and what's been done to my food before I eat it. I like to eat unprocessed, fresh food. When I can't do that, I at least like to eat the least processed food that I can. So, scientific knowledge continues to advance, and our information on food and its treatment also advances. You may remember the uproar over saccharin and the FDA's approval and the subsequent understanding that saccharin may cause cancer in humans. Saccharin now carries a warning label on it, and it's on these little packets that you have here for the committee's use in their coffee. Even if there is a minuscule risk, or even maybe if there isn't an established scientific risk, when I pay money for food, I like to know what's in it. I like to know the sugar content and the calorie content of my food. Much has been published about the fact that irradiation may be or is hazardous to your health. There's a study from India that shows that out of children who were fed irradiated wheat, a large percentage of them developed precursors to leukemia. So there is definitely a body of scientific information that does suggest that irradiation is dangerous. Also, one method of irradiation involves the use of nuclear waste. It's a separate issue, but again, important, and one that I think that we should all keep in mind. Many countries have banned irradiation. Again, this resolution is not the ban, but just for your information. Great Britain, West Germany, New Zealand, Scandinavia, and Japan is either considering or has recently also banned irradiation. For the committee's information, you pass it around. This is a list of states that have either banned or have pending resolutions or have at least required labeling or studies to be done concerning irradiation. Even the University of Alaska, who is working on a study on irradiation, recognizes that irradiation, at the least, lessens nutritional value of your food. So I would encourage you to pass the resolution out of committee and support the fact that we should be able to have the right to know what has happened to our food before we buy it. Thank you.
Any discussion or questions for the witness?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to say that I think I go along with Beth's comments that I think we do have the right to know, and I support the labeling of this. I don't know if the full story is in on the other side of it as far as the effects, but I certainly want to know, and I think it's a good consumer resolution.
Okay, we have no further members of the public signed up to testify. Is there anyone like to testify on this that hasn't signed up? What's the will of the committee? Representative Menard?
Chairman, I would move it out with individual recommendation.
Any objection? Okay, no objection. Motion carried.
Mr. Chairman, though, Beth, if you could look at line 13 on page 1, is the word supposed to be radiation or irradiation? Page 1, line 13, 60 spices have been approved for radiation by the United States Food and Drug Administration.
It's irradiation, pardon me, that is a type, I believe that's a typographical.
Okay. I think we can do that as a technical.
It can be done as an engrossing change.
Right.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Can we make that a help yet?
No, I don't think we have to do that. Page 1, line 13.
I used to be a proofreader by profession.
Yeah, they can correct that. Type it out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. In your proposed committee bills file, there's two proposed committee pieces of legislation, one of which has to do with employee access to personnel files. If there's no, it was given to the members on Tuesday. They didn't approve that for introduction. Okay, that's going to be read across tomorrow. Second, in your package, you'll find a proposed piece of legislation on plant closures. And I'd like you to take the opportunity to study that and bring it up for discussion next week for possible introduction as a committee bill. The next matter on the agenda is House Bill 535. This is a committee bill, and there's two people signed up to testify about this legislation. Ms. Jarrell, would you like to go first? Yeah, well, mostly if you could just wait, if you could just hold right there for a second. Would staff like to give us an explanation of the proposed committee substitute?
Thank you for the record. My name is Ginger Bain, aide to the House Labor and Commerce Committee. The proposed committee substitute on House Bill 535 that we have before us makes two changes. In paragraph A, it changes the 4 hours to 2 hours to require that a person using a supplied air situation has to have a break in fresh air every 2 hours. The second part of the bill, paragraph B, has been changed to put it back to the way the draft was originally drafted. And that it, what it does now is it requires that if you work for an employer who requires that you fill out a safety report at the end of a shift using a respirator, that the safety report has to say on it that you will not be discriminated against if you make a report of a safety violation. The previous version of the bill had a very long and complicated new kind of report that had to be submitted. The Department of Labor has informed us that the report was unnecessary and would have created a burden and would have offered no help to employers or employees in this situation, so revert back to the statute as it stands that it's against law to discriminate against a worker who has submitted a safety claim.
Okay. Ms. Jarrell, would you like to?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Risa Jarrell, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for ETC of Alaska. I do think the language in Section B is greatly improved. We had major problems with the long, drawn-out reporting requirements and the paperwork that we knew that was going to be forthcoming. We still have a problem with the legislation with the mandatory once every two-hour break for the employees. At the present time, if someone's using lead in OSHA regulations, you have to give them a break every 4.4 hours. That's one substance. Under the requirements on the various substances, they have a standard paragraph in there that the employee shall be allowed to stop work at any time to go wash his face and clean himself. In a confined situation, you get hot, you get sweaty, and all of them, it's quite frequent that they will be taking their own breaks without a mandatory 15-minute break. We have a respirator program that we developed, and for our members and other people that want to look at it, and one of the items we have in it is a standard form for companies to post for their employees sample respirator program. And one of the items is item number 6. This program will be under constant review to determine that it meets its stated goal of providing maximum employee protection. Suggestions for improvements of this program should be submitted to blank at blank and are openly encouraged. Questions should be referred to the following person. If you have a valuable employee that is knows how to work with toxic substances and use a respirator, I would doubt very seriously that Section 1 would be needed, because you're not going to be discriminate against this person. This is a valuable person. You want to keep them around, and you want to encourage them to say, hey, we've got a problem over here, or this is how we can improve this program. Also, as just a general comment, is in this box, I went to the Department of Labor yesterday, and in this box is various pamphlets of regulations on the construction industry. I skipped sawmills and bakeries and stuff like that, just the construction industry. We feel like that we have enough regulations on us, there's enough statutes on the books already to very well take care of employees at the present time.
Questions for Ms. Chair?
I'd like to. Could you summarize what's in the box?
Well, we have a word I can't pronounce. It's abbreviated DVCP. This is some industrial breakdowns of injuries. That's not regulations. That's some numbers for that came up. OSHA safety general code. All you don't have is respirators. Construction code. Lead. Special regulations on lead.
So which ones are state regulations?
All these were
regulations are.
All these came from the Department of Labor yesterday.
Right, but the OSHA standards are federal regulations as well.
The state has its own program. The state, I believe it was 2 years ago, took over complete control of the occupational safety and health in the state of Alaska.
Okay. Further questions or questions? Is there more in the box, or is that all?
Then there's General Safety Code Volume 2, Toxic and Hazardous Substances, the General Administrative Code covering safety, Construction Industry Standard Digest of Safety Health. I don't know what this one is. Construction Checklist for Self-Inspection, so you can go around your own job site and have a checklist. Special Regulations on Ethylene Oxide, Inorganic Arsenic, all these little yellow tags are respirator use. Hazardous communications, vinyl cyanide or something. I didn't get asbestos. I didn't think that was a thing. Designated toxic and hazardous substance and physical agents. That's heat stroke and stuff like that. Then there's another volume to the little red book. It's volume 3. This is all the fire stuff. Indoor air quality, industrial health in general. This is a pamphlet on worker right to know, and you all have seen this wonderful one last year on the worker right to know. And then a record keeping booklet for occupational injuries and accidents and deaths.
And then Davidson,
I guess I'm not, I don't know if you're being cynical, I don't know if you're saying these are useful. I just like to have a.
They are useful, but I think. Looking at the volumes of stuff that our guys have to be aware of at all, and also there are already respirator requirements already on projects. There are already requirements on the books in the regulations saying that our guys have to take a break whenever they want to wash their sweaty faces and be encapsulated in the respirator. I can just believe this legislation is necessary, quite frankly.
You see this slip, if I may, Mr. Chairman. The mandated 2 consecutive hour probation is what you're objecting to?
Yes, sir.
And I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand. You said that it's not necessary because it's already a matter of fact that they take
their own breaks
to talk to CS maybe. And is this against company policy or with the blessing of the company or?
Well, it's in the regulations that we have to let them do that, and if you have, as I say, a valuable employee that is skilled in this area, one, using a respirator properly and dealing with the, knowing what to look for with these substances around, and in certain situations you have to have one guy working and one guy observing him in case he has a problem so he can drag him out if there's a problem, that it's not necessary. We're taking care of it already. It's being done.
Thank you.
Representative Furness?
Yes, Chairman. I believe Mrs. Urisa has indicated that I guess the federal statute now require a break every 4.4 hours of consecutive work. Were you aware of that when the legislation was drafted?
Representative Furness, this summer the chairman of this committee worked a job that you supplied air, in which I worked 6 hours without having a break. So I really doubt, unless Ms. Gerald can produce that particular federal regulation before us and say that it's also effective to asbestos work, that testimony was all-inclusive of all uses of respirators.
No, under lead. I believe I said lead. There's a mandatory every 4.4 hours. Have to let the guy loose, but also in all of these, they mentioned that you have to let the guy take a break at will to wash his face.
And the difficulty that arises there, for example, Furness, is the break to wash the face opportunity doesn't necessarily present itself in the manner as the employees would ever take the advantage of it in a supplied air situation where you have to and go a utilize a decontamination procedure when you're dealing with toxic substances.
That just may change just for a second. I guess my thought is 2 hours appears to be a little short. I'm sure you're looking at exhaustion within a period. It appears to be that 4.4 hours to comply with at least the lab statutes would be a more appropriate time, and I guess I'd like for the body to at least think about that for a few moments. I'm not prepared at this time to put it into motion, but at least before we conclude, I would like to just try to...
It was the chair's intent to have a hearing on the legislation today, but not to move it yet.
Okay.
And to give the committee the opportunity to work with legislation. Representative Copeland.
Yes, I was just wondering in terms of the reporting requirement, which you go prefer in the original or the...
There, it's a lot better than it was.
In that case, the purpose of the discussion that we think in one bill, I move it, we adopt the CSR House Bill 535, Labor and Commerce, the bill before us.
Is there any objection to the motion adopted during substitute for discussion? Please, hearing none, three substitutes before us. Are there further questions for the witness at this time?
Not so much for the witness, I'll get to the discussion.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ahab of the Department of Labor.
My name is Mr. Ahab, Deputy Director for Occupation Safety and Health, Department of Labor. The Department of Labor supports this new committee substitute. The major problem with wearing a respirator is heat stress and dehydration, especially if you're wearing a full body suit. It becomes very hot, and we believe a two-hour break is a reasonable break. The American Industrial Hygiene Association recommends for heat stress that there be a morning and afternoon 15-minute break and a 30-minute lunch break. And we have no objections now that the record keeping time has changed the
record.
Mr. Arab, you just testified that some organization recommends a morning, an afternoon, and a 30. It appears that if a person is working an 8-hour day, that we're basically talking about one within that 4.4 hour, 4 hours in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. I'm questioning you. You're supporting the 2 hours versus a 3 or maybe 4 hour period of time. Perhaps you could expand
on that. When the bill came out first, when it said 4 hours, the reason why we felt it wasn't a good idea was that most, if you have an 8-hour work shift, most people get a break after 4 hours for lunch. And therefore, we couldn't see the reason for having a 4-hour break. Now, as it says, there is a problem, and the problem is dehydration. And wearing a respirator for 2 hours, even for 2 hours, is a long time to wear a respirator. We would feel that a 2-hour break is, that is the problem that this committee is trying to solve. A 2-hour break would be much more reasonable than a 4-hour break.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative,
do we have any doctors, lung doctors, submit any testimony to this?
Representative Boucher, we could ask Dr. Thorne of the Department of Labor to testify.
I would like to have her testify. She, obviously, this is an asbestos abatement.
We can ask her to come next time we have the report.
Yeah, I would like to request Dr. Thorne be here because she was probably, this largely came about of an asbestos abatement.
Right.
Now, I'd like to hear what she's got to say on it.
Unfortunately, she's ill today. She's ill today. She would have been here.
Yeah.
I will make sure.
All right. Okay.
Then the chair will coordinate with Department of Labor. When Dr. Thorne is available, we can bring it up again for the committee so they have the opportunity to ask some questions.
Sure.
Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public here to testify on this legislation this time? Okay. Hearing none, we'll hold this over. And next matter on the agenda today is Senate Bill 322. I'm going to take a short recess before we deal with Senate Bill 322. We'll try to get back here in 5 or 10 minutes.
We have a committee substitute.
That's what we've been waiting for. We couldn't seem to get the drafters to agree with it. Go ahead and bring the meeting back to order. What I'm going to propose we do is, since the drafters seem to have a lot of difficulties over there today, is deal with those points that are at issue before the committee now, and then come back at 4 o'clock when they once again postpone the time that the draft will be ready, and have the draft before the committee at that time. Several issues that I think I would like the committee to make some decisions on it include both the issue of the vocational education and the level of competency required by the new legislation, which was addressed in the Tuesday meeting, and the issue of what the language relating to chiropractic should be. I think we can deal with both those at this point in time. Staff could give us a short reminder of exactly what that vocational issue was, and the proposal that's going to appear in the CS.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Gervain, and I aid the House Labor and Commerce Committee. At issue on the rehab section are two issues. The first is, should the committee include in a committee substitute a grandfather clause or some kind of grandfathering in for currently practicing rehab specialists that do not have the licenses or credentials listed under the definition of rehab specialist? And within that question of grandfathering, there's two questions. Should we have an open-ended grandfather clause, in other words, to grandfather in anyone that has been practicing up to standards, or should we simply have a grandfather clause that allows, gives people who are currently practicing the time to get the credentials under the definition? There's two different issues here. One would be for people who have no intention of getting the credentials but feel that they have demonstrated competency, and it would leave the department with the position of having to judge whether that person has, in fact, demonstrated competency. Or do we just want to open the window long enough for some currently practicing people who are within a year of gaining the credentials listed under the bill in order to meet the minimum qualifications? There's another issue that may come before the committee later, and that has to do with some confusion over the definition of rehab specialist as to whether or not this, the definition that we have currently in the bill is accurate. We'll have some more information on that from the drafter later today. But the first issue is the grandfather issue.
Okay. Representative Furness.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, you may recall Representative Hudson had offered an amendment to the body's work discussion the other day. It was the intent at that time, my understanding, is to open the window briefly, be it 2 years or 3 years. In fact, the management group the other day endorsed a 3-year window to give those persons time to become fully certified or whatever the process is. And I would certainly support that. I'm reading the suggested amendment, and I'm not sure if it addresses that limited time period, but I would like to give this amendment some consideration.
Okay. So it's the committee is interested in pursuing this once we get the work draft before us, and I guess one of the main issues is here is how long a window of time you want to open up, or if you want to, or whether you want to base it on just strictly whether somebody's qualified or not to do the job. And once they do become qualified under the regulations, they would automatically be included. Representative Copeland?
Perhaps we need some information on how the qualification can be met. I mean, is it feasible, or do you have to go to Chicago to make a point?
Representative Miller.
Are we talking about the difference between qualified and certified? The woman who was with us the other day that accompanied Representative Hudson to the meeting talked about being qualified to perform the services that she had been under her business license during the last 3 or 4 years here in the state of Alaska. But she's not fully certified, I guess, in her profession. So I'd hate to get confused about the semantics. And I guess Representative Furness is speaking to a 3-year window for people to achieve their professional certification. But qualification, to get qualified, I don't think is what we're discussing.
Certified.
Because there are people who are qualified to perform the service that are not yet professionally certified.
We've had some testimony that's expressed serious concerns over adopting a large window period, simply because we also had testimony this summer. There's a lot of people out there practicing in this field that aren't qualified to do the job. So the committee may want to look at discriminating between those people who are qualified and those people who are simply out there in this field practicing, as far as falling into a window period to get certification. Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's somewhat confusing if somebody is a specialist already. I mean, if they've been working on the
in the field, they're what is it, on the job training that they receive? How can a person call himself a rehabilitation specialist? In fact, we don't know, we don't have the criteria to establish what that is previous to this effort to quantify that.
And judging people's qualifications, I think, would be beyond us, or what we might be able to write in the statutes that would probably be taken care of in regulations. I'd prefer some sort of window of opportunity for people to get their professional certification. Those people who are, you know, doing a good job now shouldn't have that much difficulty. We should find out what the time frame is, or time period it takes to achieve professional certification, and make that the window of opportunity, and put people on notice with this legislation as has a high profile, I think, in the press, and let people know who are performing their services now that they have a certain amount of time, you know, whatever the length of the course is, make it a reasonable period of time to achieve that professional certification. I'd be much more comfortable with that, letting the professional societies, whatever their standard of performance is, when they pass out their certificates, to let that be, you know, the cutoff or the judgment of who's qualified to perform these services and who isn't.
Okay, Representative Curtis.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I wonder if this amendment has been forwarded to Mrs. McClintock for analysis and consideration.
She's nodding her head, yes.
I'd like to hear a response as to its, does it meet the test?
Would you like to join us?
I guess if I may restate the question.
Please.
The question, you may have been here the other day when Representative Hudson was here, and with the young lady who was currently providing rehabilitation services would, in essence, be put out of business based upon the passage of the legislation. She had asked for a window of time by which to at least complete the bachelor's requirement and whatever. I note here that we say that has requested the Department of Labor to determine that the person is qualified as a rehabilitation specialist, and the department has determined that they've been actively employed, et cetera, and possess the necessary skill. Does this amendment give you the latitude of assisting those persons within that, say, 3-year window or 2-year window, whatever is determined?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jackie McClintock, Director of the Workers' Compensation Division. If I could, I need to borrow that a little bit. We have discussed an earlier proposed amendment and also Representative Hudson's. And I guess before I address that, if you don't mind, I'd like to go back to, I think, what they were talking about more yesterday, and that was Ms. Vanderpool was stating that, yes, she needed a window period, and she was talking about a year to meet the criteria to become to become certified. I think a lot of this is that they possess the abilities, they possess the skills, right, but they're not able to sit for the test. And again, Representative Collins is a good one to call on for information on this, but they're not able to sit for the test. So what she was asking is that she would be given a window period of a year to bring those skills up to speed, and I believe the ad hoc committee felt the same way, that a person be extended a year to bring their skills up to speed or their background to speed to be able to become certified. And then number two, they were talking about a time period of, say, 60 days from the time of that the bill was enacted that somebody would have to apply for that type of waiver for the person to come in. I think in the drafted bill, what we were looking at is that the department, by regulation, could say what equivalent was. And let's say that the people who are in a state or even a different country, Canada, whatever, that has a different certification that comes in from that CIRS, the Certified Insurance Rehabilitation Specialist, or the CRC, which is a Certified Rehabilitation Consultant, but they could have an equivalent type of certification that would meet that type of criteria.
Thank you.
Yes,
very much so. Thank you.
Representative Menard.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jackie, what is the program that they have? Are they taking university classes or college classes to become certified? Or
yes, there's two different, and I am sorry, I apologize. I can get a hold of the copies of the CIRS and the CRC. The Labor Management Ad Hoc Committee has those, and I will make those available to you. I'll have them faxed down if nothing else this week. But there are, I believe, on both programs, there's a certain amount of education. The CIRS is a lesser qualification than is the Certified Rehabilitation Consultant. I believe the CRC takes a master's in rehabilitation, and I think the CIRS takes a bachelor's degree and then has certain criteria to put on top of that. And I will get that for you. I don't know what I can't say what it is right now, but there is that type of educational criteria.
Mr. Chair, my concern is if we have some of these folks that are working in the field already, and then they then they have to be taking classes to pick this up. If it's a one-year period, I don't know, is that enough time for them to be, still some of them are working in the field and they have to do some classwork, and I understand in Mrs. Vanderpool saying she's going to Seattle to take these classes. And so I didn't know if it was my understanding that she needed a two-year one, but has anyone?
No, 2 years, I thought so.
Yeah, and then the group, the ad hoc group that was working on this, said a three-year window. Now we're talking about a one-year, so I'm just
I guess it's really confusing that.
Yeah.
I was giving a speech yesterday, Mr. Vanderpool was at it, and she had basically come by and she said, I was really talking about a year.
I guess we need to touch base
a year or two.
My memory was that she said she needed a year.
She told us two.
And I will read from a letter that, is that right?
That's what
I
said.
Right. A letter that was written by the Joint Labor and Management Task Force to someone that had asked this question. It was regarding vocational rehabilitation professional. You asked if current vocational rehabilitation providers would be grandfathered to qualify as specialists. The answer was from the ad hoc committee. We have determined that we feel in fairness we would grant current vocational rehabilitation professionals operational status for 1 year. We would require them to meet the CRC or CIRS designation within that 1 year period to continue to qualify as vocational rehabilitation professionals. So I think that was their understanding, but. I guess obviously we need some more discussion.
Well, Representative Curtis, what I'm going to be looking at here is if we could get a conceptual motion before the committee, possibly that's an example of what the form it could take, and then if there's nobody ready to make that, we can continue with the discussion. If somebody has that, it might help articulate the discussion.
What I'm going to ask Mrs. McClintock, if you've had a chance to read this amendment, does this serve the purpose? I guess that's my question. In fact, let me use your, who has a clean copy of that?
Oh, okay, right.
If this meets the test, then I would put this on the floor for discussion.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it certainly would meet the test as far as the window period to apply. In other words, to make application saying, I want to become certified. And I believe, we have a one year. I think the thing that misses, it seems, is that it doesn't give a time period that the person has to become qualified. So it gives you the 3 months that the person has to make application. It gives you the employment that they have to be actively employed in this type of endeavor for at least 1 year, but it does not meet the criteria that they have to become cured within a certain length of time.
So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will place this amendment
before us for discussion at this time. Do we all have copies of the motion? Here's maybe staff could make us a few more copies, please. It's kind of buried in the packet. I think one of the things that we heard was this concern that the people who fit into this window still be qualified to do the work.
Yeah.
Representative Davis.
My question to the representative from Anchorage is, if we have this window, you wanted to define how long the window will be available, is that correct?
Correct, Mr. Chairman. Representative Davidson, as I understand the amendment, it covers the period of time by which they are to request the department for at least the waiver. It also addresses their active involvement in the field, but it does not do, and I suspect we could probably make this number three, and I would ask Mrs. McClintock for some suggested language, and I would recommend that we maybe set it at 2 years. 2 year period of time by which they must complete the necessary professional training or educational training for one or two of those designations.
I think it's going to be at least 2 years, because I envision the situation where someone is working on their certification, maybe getting sick or getting pregnant, and they're out of the situation for continuing on. That's one thing I've learned, I think, in my short time here, is that you can't cover all human situations when you're trying to particularize a window for a group of people or individuals.
Representative Copeland.
What is involved in certification?
Mm-hmm. Representative Copeland, that's what I was saying, that I do have, and I read it before, and the ad hoc committee does have the CIRS certification standards and CRC. I was discussing with Representative Menard that I
But what do they include? I mean,
okay, that the CIRS, I'm sure one of the things requires a bachelor's degree because it is the lesser, and I believe it has an offset of a nursing degree. I just am not quite up to speed, and I would have to get more information if you want that. Oh, good, we have that. And the CRC, the Certified Rehabilitation Consultant, I believe requires a master's in rehabilitation. So it is, of the two, it is the higher level of certification or requirements.
Representative Boucher?
Well, to me, Jackie, in the years that I've dealt with this highly complex issue, turf battle always seems to come down. And the working person and the business person is left out of this as the healthcare providers argue about who can do what to who. We're having it right now. I mean, the chiropractors are unhappy about it. Well, fine. I want to know why specifically. Is it because you're being left out of the loop? Because these people see their livelihoods. Now, I would ask you, and if I may, what I'm trying to do is to understand the complexity of the specifics. I'm trying to understand the philosophy, and I'm sure that you feel like a ping-pong ball in this deciding, quote, who is the qualified person. But let me ask you a question. Rehabilitation specialist. Would a person that provides acupuncture be considered as a rehabilitation specialist?
No, sir, it would not. No, when we're talking about rehabilitation, we're talking about, in this term, we're talking about vocational rehabilitation, the person that works with a person to assess their skills and to place them in employment. So I think what you may be referring to is more of the physical rehabilitation than vocational rehabilitation.
Isn't there ever an overlapping in those two there? I mean, if a person is impaired in a certain way, it requires
but again,
a combination of the mechanics of knowledge and the mechanics of medicine.
You have, under our act, two types of provider. You have a medical and a physical type of provider, and then you have a vocational rehabilitation provider.
And you have one that's both.
I don't believe that usually, you'll have sometimes that a vocational provider will get into looking through, and particularly if they have the type of nursing background or something like that, that they can look at physical files or see what their capacities are. But again, what we're trying to explain here is the vocational portion of it.
I understand that. Another question. Are you happy with the current definition of what the state calls a rehabilitation specialist?
You mean under the proposed...
I'm talking about you, yourself.
And
Jackie McClintock, who has been working for the state in this field for years and seen these laws come and go. If you were sitting in my seat, would you be happy with the legislation?
And again, let me just ask the question, I understand the question to me, but do you mean under the proposed law or under the current law?
I mean under
the proposed. All right. I am I am satisfied that the ad hoc committee looked closely into the definition of CIRS and CRC. We have definitions surrounding CRC, and then we also have proposed regulations that we have written around the qualifications. I have no problem with the way they're defining it, and I wish I were better up to speed on to tell you exactly what the provisions are, but I am happy with what they have proposed. I also am not certainly adverse, the Department of Labor, I don't believe, would be certainly not adverse to leaving a window period open for people to come up to speed to be able to deliver those services. But we do want people that are qualified too.
Okay, that's fine.
Right.
Why not just grandfather them? They're already, you say, come up to speed. Okay, if someone is right now a rehabilitation specialist certified by the state, are they grandfathered into this process?
There is no certification by
right. That's the problem. There's a lot of people out there that testimonies indicated that are doing this but may not necessarily be qualified.
We want them to get certified.
We want them to get certified. We don't want to grandfather people in who may not be qualified to do the job.
All right, okay. All right, fine then. Okay, I go back again to the criteria. You're satisfied with the criteria that would establish them as rehabilitation.
Yes, sir. And we had discussed with the ad hoc committee when we went through these things and the department, even though the administration's not taking a particular stand on it, we did discuss with the ad hoc committee and we didn't have that, any kind of problem. Just so that the problem that came up thereafter was should there be a time for these people to cure any kind of lacking in education that they have.
I'm sure there are other questions. I won't belabor that point. I guess the point, you've been around here for a long time. And I've talked to you about this subject for, I think,
15 years. No, not that long. In the past decade. Yes, that's
close. Is this the best piece of legislation that we could put forward?
You're asking my
personal opinion. Yes, I am. You're an expert.
Okay, then I will tell you straightforward. And this is not to be reflective of the administration or the department.
I
personally think that it's the best piece of legislation I've ever seen come off.
Okay, all right.
December 9th.
Okay, you're giving straightforward answers.
We do have the drafters working on another proposal to deal with this issue, and it will be before the committee. We also have Representative Hudson's amendment. I think when we get our draft proposal before us, we'll be able to take a look at the two of them and see which one possibly, rather than just trying to create it right at this moment in time. So I'm going to hold Representative Hudson's amendment on the table here before us. We'll be able to compare the two and get the two proposals. At this point in time, I'd like to talk a little bit about the concept of the committee substitute that's going to be prepared, what's coming forth, and run through the changes again that we talked about earlier this week. There have been some revisions since we addressed this previously. First of all, I think we all agree that the purpose of this legislation is to save Alaskans work, to keep Alaskans working, and also to improve this system as a more efficient system of delivery of the services to our people out there. We're hoping that it's going to put people back to work. And to that effect, one of the first changes that's going to be in the committee substitute that's going to be before the committee is a proposed mandated rate decrease of 6%. If you remember from the testimony we had, I guess it was last month in Anchorage, the actuarial numbers say there's a 2% hard dollar savings contained within the hard dollar numbers that are in the legislation. Plus, we had some testimony that indicated there could have been a possible 4% soft dollar savings. Putting those two, we get a 6% mandated across the board rate decrease with a moratorium on additional increases for 18 months. And that's what the chair is going to propose to the committee and the committee substitute.
Mr. Chairman, if I just make a comment on that. I understand the intent of the 6%. In fact, I know the first draft was 10%. And I recall us taking a vote to look at least 15 to 20%. I've since become aware that this may indeed cause some problems within the industry, particularly because of the status of one of the providing insurers, and that the other companies may be forced to somewhat share a potential loss situation. I don't object to it being in the draft, but I think this is one area that we may want to get some additional testimony on to find out the real situation and its ultimate impact. If it can be done, I certainly endorse it. If it's going to create a situation that will raise rates over time, then we need to at least have the input. I'd appreciate at least that consideration once the document's been prepared.
One of the ways that I arrived at the 6% number was, of course, the testimony that we had last month as to the potential hard dollar and the soft dollar savings, which was 2 and 4. And Mr. Roller's concerns that were expressed last Tuesday about doing much more than a 10%, even that it may cause some problems within the industry. We want to cut costs, and I think that this legislation, to be effective and to address public concerns, is going to have to present a reasonable, rational savings. And I think if the way it's structured now, we've got evidence that it's a 6, and that's what I'm going to put before the committee and the committee substitute. At that point in time, it'll be for us to talk about as a group here. Additionally, the committee substitute is going to contain a proposal to provide for a rebate of 10% for employers in the assigned risk pool and 5% for employers not in the assigned risk pool if they have a safety program that meets the standards established by the Occupational Safety Code and have had no OSHA violations subject, and these are the more serious fines, during the period covered by the annual premium. And that was, we discussed that with the representatives of the Labor Management Task Force last Tuesday, and with those changes, they were agreeable to that provision. It was key that it be targeted in on the assigned risk pool individuals for the larger 10% decrease, and that it not be just for no safety violations, but also be that somebody incorporated a safety program in the workplace. The third change in the Labor and Commerce version proposed version will be that the mandatory fine for the failure to carry workers' compensation insurance will be escalated from $1,000 to $10,000. The fourth provision will include a provision that in the annual reports to the Division of Workers' Compensation, it will have to include the number of claims filed and the percent of claims which have been controverted by that particular insurer for the year with which the annual report was submitted. If you remember, we had a lot of testimony that through the public hearing process that a lot of insurers were simply controverting all claims. Difficult to know that unless we have some data. So this will be for the first time we'll get some accurate reporting data on that situation out there. And if that's the case, we may want to take further legislative action at a future time.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just go back to number three just for a brief moment. We had discussion of the increase of the fine from $1,000 to $10,000, and I think I interjected last meeting. I thought the $10,000 may be a little high, and that we may want to look at $5,000. I'm not prepared at this time to make a motion to that effect, but once the final document is out, I would hope to secure at least some additional testimony on this particular item. As testified by the management group the other day, a person who cannot afford the workers' comp coverage probably can't afford the $1,000, and it simply doesn't make sense to put it at 10. We may want to seek a happy medium there and make it at least 5. So I'd like to at least leave that question open for a while.
Certainly. And what I'm going to offer to the committee members is, if not this afternoon, if we don't get it in time, but next week when we do bring the bill up again, because we're going to have it before the committee over the weekend, is that they anyone they would like to have testify, they could ask to come forward and ask them a question if they have a particular concern about where we need some particular expertise like that. The one point on the $10,000, I think that's true. There are some people who can't afford the insurance, and that's why they don't seek it. But clearly, the $10,000 fine would be an effective deterrent for those who could afford it, simply refuse to do it, refuse to comply with the statutes. So we may want to look at something along that. Number five was to amend the annual report to break out the costs of both the plaintiff's and the defense attorney's fees. Currently, the defense attorney's fees are not itemized, and this was another one of the issues that we heard. It was very difficult to see how much resources the insurance companies were putting into the defense, whether it was appropriate or not. And this would be for the first time they would be separated out as a separate category. We did have some testimony that the current forms do reflect this as a separate category, but the insurance companies simply don't fill it out. Now they would be compelled to fill it out.
One of them does, the detective partner, the only one.
Oh. Item six is to provide that the employer's choice for an IME, that's an independent medical examination, is limited to more than one change. An automatic right to do one change. The bill currently limits the employee's right to one change. This doesn't preclude referrals to specialists or referrals from one doctor for a good reason. It only says that that person's options with no reason at all are limited to one, and that if we're going to do that for the employee, we felt we should do that for the employer also. Number seven has to do with the stress language we discussed earlier. Number eight is a provision that includes language that requiring that an independent medical exam must be authorized within the same specialty as the treating physician unless the board agrees on case by case basis to authorize a medical examination by a physician who is not within that same specialty of the employee's physician.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is another area I'd like for us to look at. In previous language, we used the word unanimously, that the board would unanimously agree. I'd like to see that language reinstated in the document. I'm prepared to make a motion if it's in order at this time.
First of all, to let the committee members know what's going on here. The board typically is formatted into groups of three, so you'll have three board members that will make a decision about what sort of independent medical examination they want. The issue then Representative Furness is raising is, should it be a unanimous vote of those three individuals to go outside an area specialty, or should it be simply a two-thirds vote? This language would require a two-thirds vote, in other words, two out of the three. The proposal would be to make it unanimous that it would take three out of three to move outside the specialty. I'd like to just go ahead and vote on that when we vote on the other issues, because that's a pretty easy thing, same as these others. It's just a number factor.
This, I think, is a very important, Chairman, and
addition to the other two that I've identified, this is one I would certainly like to leave open for that inclusion, changing back to the original language.
Yeah, I think we can facilitate that very easily. Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to ask the representative from Anchorage why it's so important that it be a unanimous decision by the board.
Well, in response, I think if you consider the nature of the IME and the question that has been raised at least to this point, it is important to have the physicians in the same specialty. We got a chiropractor against a chiropractor, an orthopedic against orthopedic, and when you go into another discipline, if there is a chiropractor and you in turn change it to an orthopedic, then there should be an extra determination. And that's why I feel that the board should unanimously review that and respond accordingly. I think that's a very, very important step there. That's number 8.
The next several amendments were amendments to conform with the suggested the testimony we had last Tuesday. And item 12, I think, is a particularly important provision to provide for the first time that when an insurance company pays an injured employee that the checks be drawn on an Alaskan financial institution, simply because we had the testimony of the time of float for many of the checks. It would take 2 weeks for people to get their money that they were trying to live on when the checks were drawn on banks from outside the state. 14 was some technical language that was important that was cleaned up. Same with 13. We went ahead and incorporated one of the earlier synopsis. There was a 1 and 2 possible committee suggestions. Seemed like everybody agreed we should go ahead and proceed with this one of those. And that was a motion, a proposal to help facilitate the timeliness of the case management by the board. It has to do with people being prepared to go to hearing before they ask for a hearing in itself.
Are you on 14,
Chairman? I'm down to 15.
Sure.
So that's basically the form that the substitute is taking at this time. So far, we have 4 specific areas of concern, the 3 that Representative Furness already identified, plus the issue of the grandfathering in or the window of opportunity for the vote rehab folks. I'd just like to say that I feel this is a very important step forward, this committee substitute's going to be. It's a much better bill than the bill that left the Senate. And I think that a lot has to do with the work that you all have put in, and I'm really proud of this committee and all the time that we spent and going through the public testimony and trying to articulate what makes sense for changes. I think it's also important to realize that we had testimony this summer that some of the most important things that we can do have to deal with workplace safety. If you want to reduce the cost of this program, the cost of this insurance, it has to do with making workplace safe. And that was some of the testimony that John Lewis gave us in our earlier hearings. And that's why I'm real disappointed that the Senate hasn't dealt with House Bill 53, which passed this committee, which has to do with safety in the workplace. And I'm certainly hoping the Senate will see the light on that at some point in time and see that that's another very effective way to reduce the cost of workers' compensation in the states by reducing the number of injuries to our workers. Well, this time, I was hoping that the drafters would have had the committee set up to put before the committee members. What I'd like to do is, do we still have 4 o'clock as a projected time? I'd like to go ahead and adjourn till 4 o'clock and bring this matter back before the committee at 4 o'clock and make sure that everybody has a copy of it, deal with Representative Furness's concerns and one by one, and hopefully have a final committee substitute to leave on the table over the weekend for people to have one last look, chance to look at it.
Okay.